26, 2008, lecture discussion number 64 on Genesis 1 through 19, specifically Genesis 15. And I cannot say enough, and I should repeat it every Sunday. I try to repeat it every Sunday. Genesis 15 is so very important. It to you, to me, to all of us, a comprehensive understanding is absolutely necessary. Here, let me put it this way. If you don't understand what's going on in Genesis 15, you're in trouble. And when I mean trouble, I mean you're not going to explain things to people. Today, as I'm writing this last night, I'm thinking to myself, why does anyone want to know what I'm going to say today? Because, as you know, I've been considering different subjects. Why does anyone need to know this? Am I crazy? That's what I ask myself a lot. Every day I ask myself. My brother and I, of course, knowing that we have a genetic predisposition for craziness, ask ourselves, are we there yet? But my point is why do you really need to know this? What value does it have? And I'll answer that when I get there, I hope, get to the section where you go, he's crazy. But Genesis 15 is so important, it becomes incumbent upon us and me and you and all of us to study this, to know it very, very well, have a comprehensive understanding of it. Go collect papers on Genesis 15. You can get, I'm starting to figure out how the internet works a little bit because I've been arguing, not to anybody in specific, just mostly amongst myself. I'm looking for position papers that disagree with me. And I find them. Well, I'm telling you, take time to accumulate a library, start collecting expository papers and read the scholars and the theologians and compare them and contrast them. Find the ones that fight with each other on Genesis 15. You should have an at-home library section that's devoted to Genesis 15. Now, having said that, if you're coming here thinking that I'm going to reproduce that for you, ain't happening. You are on your own. At very best, I can't say this enough. I need to repeat it. All you're getting here is a very shallow start. It's all I can accomplish for you. Now, Genesis 15, previously we established as the major theme. He says, how can I know I'm going to be saved? And we get this complex answer that God gives Abraham. Every child you have is someday going to ask you, Mom, Dad, how can I know I'm saved? Every friend, and John and Jeffy are absolutely correct. We're coming into some weird stuff. Alaska is in real trouble. Look, I talked to the bank. I still with Bill and Bonnie. They don't know what to do. The bank doesn't have any idea. What do we do? We could have a president that will send us back to the 70s. He'll cut the military. He'll cut offshore drilling. He will cut gas. He will cut, oh, my goodness, timber, mining. We will be a fishing tourism And that's, by the way, if you ever read Jimmy Carter, that was his vision for us, was to make us fishing and tourism. A little bit of sled dog racing in between, but it certainly wasn't the storehouse of minerals that the United States would need. He wanted this to be a huge park. We're headed back there for a while. And those of you who've lived here when I did, and I remember it, it's going to be some tough, interesting times if it goes that direction. And the bank, they look at me like, we really don't like you very much. Well, that's not true. We like you. We want you to have a different loan on your building that you have. But we can't make you do it. And we got nobody to take your place. Hi. And that's where we're at with that. That's an interesting thing. So, my point being is that this could be very difficult time coming. We're seeing things that are interesting. We're seeing an anti-Israel brew now coming. This guy in Iran who once, he calls Israel a stinking corpse that needs to be destroyed. That's powerful language from a leader of a country over there adjacent to Israel, essentially. And so how close are we to Ezekiel 38? What do we do? When people ask us, and you have unsaved friends, I know I've been over to your houses, some of you, and your unsaved friends have been there. What do you do? What do you talk to them about? And that's what I'm trying to accomplish here. That's why Genesis 15 answers the question, how can you know you're saved? How can I know that I'm saved? He says, take me in the form of a 3-year-old heifer, a 3-year-old female goat, a 3-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. The red heifer, as we've discussed, is contact with death cleansing. You're dirty because you are contacting death. The person next to you is dying. You rode with them in the car today. You have contact with a dead body. You are a dead body. You need cleansing. Understand that. So we have the cleansing of contact with death. We have the cleansing of the captive bride, the cleansing of the priesthood before Yom Kippur, a day of atonement. We have the man found slain in the field, Jerusalem which is above and free, the virgin birth, son of promise. That's all in the heifer. Have a nice day. Get your library. The goat, expiated sin, uncleanness, sin from sin. Atonement, the Yom Kippur again, this one day. One goat dies, one goat lives. We have a goat for YHVH. We have a goat for Azazel in the wilderness. The Shekinah glory is above the mercy seat. It's the bondage of Mount Sinai. It's the son of flesh. It's the sprinkling of blood. It's the cloud of incense. It's the Ten Commandments. It's law. There's your goat. Last Sunday, the ram. I ask this question. He found a ram caught in the thorns, Genesis 22. What, in your mind, do you think the ram looked like? Do you think doll sheep? Is that what you think? Big horns, big, you know, powerful St. Louis rams? They have to make the shofar, that's right. Or did you think little itty-bitty sheep-looking ram? Now, who has a farm? Ben Owen. What do the rams, the sheep rams, look like? Mm-hmm. And I got to have shofars. What kind of ram did Abraham have? When he saw it caught in the thorns. What was it doing there? Where did it come from? Those are the kinds of questions I want you to consider. Do that during the commercial. I'm sorry, during the sermon. The ram is substitutionary sacrifice. It is therefore the sacrificial system. It is the two shofars. The one is blown at Sinai. The other is blown at the Great Awakening. What's the Great Awakening? It is the rapture. It is the resurrection. It is the coming of the bridegroom. The bridegroom cometh. Exodus 19:16 and Revelation 4:1. Both of those have something in common. Both of those have wedding symbolatry to them. So we have this wedding that's wrapped up in the ram. We'll have to get to that today. With the curse caught in the thorns, the crown of thorns, the meaning of the crown of thorns. Why Christ put a crown of thorns on top of his head at his crucifixion. Hey, and I discussed it last week a little bit. Can God get caught in thorns? The ram is Christ. It can't be. How does Christ get caught in thorns? He has to put himself in the thorns. Why would he put himself in the thorns? Because in order to get us out of the thorns, a Redeemer has to put himself in our place. So we have to come out of the thorns and he has to go in. That's why he has the crown of thorns on his head. Somebody will ask you someday at Easter, why did they put a crown of thorns on his head? And you will answer Genesis 15 and Genesis 22. And that you're stuck in the thorns. And now you see Adam and Eve, don't you? How was Eve doing when she came back to Adam? She's stuck in the thorns. Somebody's got to get her out of the thorns. Does he get her out of the thorns? Adam. What did he do instead? He joined her in the thorns, didn't he? See the difference? Understanding the typology, but the difference between Adam and Christ is critical. I'll make a comment here pretty soon that Christology is a missing ingredient to solving Genesis 15. And something else that we'll get to. Also, the ram talks, gets you into the seven trumpet judgments of Revelation chapter 8 through 11. And that's very important today because we're probably, a couple of weeks away from that. I'm kidding. The consecration of the priesthood is in the ram. What is the consecration of the priesthood? It is the calling out. It is the separating out. Now you understand why the shofar is blown on Revelation 4:1. The calling out, the separating of them, of the priesthood out. Now on top of that is the four, it is finishes. There are four times in scripture where Christ says it is finished or it is done or it is completed. There's four of them. You need to know those four. Obvious question about those four is, do they all finish the same thing, or are they four parts to a whole? What do I think they are? I think they're four parts, or at least three parts to a whole. We'll argue that when we get to it. But what exactly was finished by Christ in each of these? Every time he said it, the one that's most famous is where? On the cross. What did he finish there? I can tell you it had something to do with what? Genesis 15. Abraham saw my day. So, cleansing from contact with death, ashes of the red heifer. Try that on your friends. Just go, hey, what's the purpose of the ashes of the red heifer? They will say to you, well, you got to clean the captive bride that's caught in the military fight. You'll go, that's true. I hope you'll do that. I hope you'll say it's got something to do with the man found slain in the field and measuring. We got to cleanse ourselves because we touched the body. But you really want to say the ashes of the red heifer, we don't have them. We need them. They're missing. They're where? In the Ark of the Covenant. You didn't see that in the movie, did you? We got the ashes of the red heifer. I can take a little bitty ash and put it in a whole bunch of water and I can clean a whole priesthood. And if I can clean a whole priesthood, what can I do, baby? I can build me a temple and I can start one incredible war. And who's going to be on your side, Israel? Will it be the United States? I don't think so. Because I know it won't. I read the book. He lets me know that Israel will be alone. Are we in the process in this country of watching Israel be isolated? I think we are. Now, that's not politically correct, but I think that's where we're headed. Sorry about not being politically correct. Not really. Fake sorry. Anyway, ashes of the red heifer cleansed from contact from death, and then I have the goat. I have cleansing from contact with sin or cleansing from sin, and now I have sacrifice and substitution. So you see the three, right? Contact with death, cleansing, sin, and sacrifice and substitute. Notice that it's one red heifer, but eventually it becomes how many goats? Because one goat can't get the job done. I got to have what? I got to have two goats to show what he's really doing with sin. How he expiates it, and then he shows he expiates it. You have to learn the word expiate. Did you learn expiate? Okay. Means to pay the price, to satisfy. I have one ram, but I got two ram's horns, and they blow at two different times. One in 1916, and what's he blowing at 1916 of Exodus? Why are we blowing the horn there? Because we have a wedding. And then I blow it at 4:1 Revelation. How come? Because the bridegroom cometh at a what? Wedding. Got two horns are being blown at weddings. How many birds I got? Two birds. Hey, that's how it all starts to fit together. I hope you see some of that. And I'm going to make the case that the two birds are the doctrine of immortality. But I get ahead of myself. If Mikey were here, Mikey would be jumping up right now saying, tell him where the angels fit in. And he's right. He's absolutely right. He seems to think, as he said last week, that we are tertiary. In other words, what he means by that is this is really about the angels, and we're just kind of added on to it. You know, angels went down the road first, and God put us in, and we kind of show them a thing or two, maybe. But we're really, it's all about the angels, and we're subject to that. I don't particularly think that's necessarily correct, but Mike has a point, and his point's very well taken. Do not disregard who's watching this. And why they're watching, and what happened to them. Okay, so far, in an elementary explanation of Genesis 15, death, sin, substitutionary sacrifice, and that's in an elementary explanation, and it's in that order. If you always ask, why did he go heifer, goat, ram? He went heifer, goat, ram because he's going death, sin, substitutionary sacrifice. Would I expect that order? Yes, I would. See, those are three elements within the redemptive work of Christ, three things he addresses. Death and sin must be resolved. And by the way, very difficult to separate death and sin, but God does. Death and sin must be resolved, and sacrifice and substitution is the what to death and sin? It's the solution to it. So I'd expect death to go on the board, sin to go on the board, and then the solution to it. And that's the order of Genesis 15. So what will the birds then be? Note. They're not divided, they're not cut, or they're not beheaded. Okay, where did I get beheaded from? Everything's cut in half, or beheaded. Where did I get beheaded from? Old King James. Old King James, the red heifer, when it's taken out into the field for the man who is slain in the field that no one knows, they behead the red heifer. So they make the extrapolation that these are beheaded. Whatever they are, they're divided or beheaded. But the birds are not. So there's the obvious question of all time, right? Why are the birds not beheaded or divided? What is the meaning of the two birds? And then why is it that they're not cut in two? They're not. They're just dead. And some say, I've never answered this. Away with the naysayers. I did answer it. I found the lecture. Okay, this is where regular attendance comes into play. Huh? I was in the other building. It was 2005. I did answer it. And I found it. Yay for me. And I did, as I said, I did answer it, but it was very, very tricky how I did it. I have to admit that. Let me tell you this. How many goats I got? Two. One lives and one dies. How many birds I got? Leviticus 14. Two. One lives and one dies. Birds equal goats. You with me so far? Okay, birds equal what? Leviticus 14. What's the purpose? Goats equal expiated sin. Birds equal? Leprosy, that's correct. So, what is leprosy a symbol of in the Bible? It's a symbol of sin. So, birds equal goats, birds equal leprosy. Leprosy equals sin, sin equals goats, therefore birds equal goat. Everybody got that? That's transitive property. It's very simple. Back to geometry again. Okay? That is not the answer to the birds. That's what we call the pre-answer. And as I said, I'll admit that I did slip the answer into a lecture that seemed unattached to Genesis 15 at the time. Notice I said seemed. And I do this time promise to resolve why the two birds were not beheaded or divided. But we're not going to do it today because today we're still with the ram. And the ram As you know, I have two shofars. And it ultimately becomes a law versus grace discussion that sends us into Galatians and Jerusalem, which is free, and the two covenants and Sinai. How do I get Sinai and the ram together? How do I do that? Because I blow the first shofar where? At Sinai, which is a wedding ceremony. But before we do that, our extra sermon subject again today, my very own contemporary, warm, fuzzy, seeker-sensitive segment that I like to call, at least it's not Leviticus, bring your friends. Now, I'm glad somebody laughed at that. I really am. It's hard. Comedy is hard. Last Sunday, I put on the board your assignments, the definition of terms, things you need to know. Test on Friday. Again, if I am correct, why do I say if? If I am correct that we are entering into a very difficult time, people are going to come to you. They will come to you, why? Because God sends them to you. God sends them to you, why? Because you're ready for them. You're ready for them, why? Because He has equipped you to be ready, and you are studied, and you are learned, and you have something that they want. What is that? Wisdom, that's correct. Good for you. So far, and I'm not going to put this back on the board, permineralization. Permineralization is the process by which bone material is replaced by mineral material that is carried there by water. So it is a fossilization. It's not a real dinosaur bone when you see it. It is a rock replica of it if it is 100% permineralized. So you have to be able to say, it's not easy. I have an over-enlarged tongue. If I eat ice, I cannot say permineralized. I had to play look when I was a little kid. It's kind of like fish. You've heard me say the story, some of you, most of you maybe not, but I went to a little room as a little boy and I couldn't say my R's or my L's. I put my tongue on top of the mouth. I have a fat tongue. Are you surprised by that? And so the guy in there would make me say, look, which is the same as saying fish. Do you have any threes? Look. And he wouldn't have to because I didn't perform the task correctly. So he got another guess. And until I could say, look, he slaughtered me at this game. Day after day after day. Did I like going to tongue class, as I call it? I hated it, and I hated this guy. How effective of a teaching technique has it been? I have never forgotten it. And, of course, I was thrilled when Eric couldn't say K's, right? R's? I couldn't remember, but I was delighted to send him to the same torture that I endured. Yes, you have to go to the speech class. Speech therapy. We'll pay for it. Anyway. Permineralize. You have to know what permineralize means. It's important to you. You have to understand the instantaneous fossilization process. Sometimes permineralization occurs instantly. That's very important for you to know that because somebody is going to say there is no God. Why? Your kids are going to say it to you. They're going to come home from college and say a professor has disproved Scripture. And you're going to say, explain to me instantaneous permineralization. Mummification. That's as we discussed it previously. Mummification is very important because animals become mummified in ice. They become mummified in oil substrates, tar, asphalt. Understanding permineralization, instantaneous fossilization, which occurs in mineral springs. I can throw an animal into mineral springs and it will become stone, the Medusa effect, very quickly, sometimes in hours, sometimes in weeks. How old is it? And then, of course, the formation of impressions gives us fossils. Carbonization gives us a kind of an ink blot, if you will, a carbon trail of the creature that was there, a black painting of it. And then my favorite, as you know, is partial permineralization, because we have dinosaurs, we have ancient animals, we have all kinds of fossils that are partially permineralized. The process is still continuing. Then I asked you to know what heme was and what globin was, because that's hemoglobin, which is part of blood, and it got you to understand the autoimmune response, because if I take heme out of a bone and I inject it in a rat and I get an autoimmune, or if I get a antibody production, then I have proved that I have found blood in a what? In a fossil. If I have blood in a fossil, what have I got? I got a very young animal here. And then I asked you to start studying the massive boneyards, the billions and billions, and I specifically said the Karoo boneyard. There are thousands and thousands of boneyards, but there are a few that are so overwhelmingly massive, the catastrophic depth of them is incomprehensible. Billions and billions, hundreds of billions of animals heaped up in a big pile. You need to know about it. How come? Because if we are in difficult times, people are coming. And if you're ready and you know and you have wisdom, they're coming to you. And then I put on this on the board. I said, everybody you meet is going to fall into four categories. You're going to find literal creationists. You're going to find progressive creationists. You're going to find theistic evolutionists. Theistic. Did I get it right? No. You're supposed to say no. Theistic evolutionists, and then you will have atheistic. Atheistic evolutionists. So progressive creationists, literal creationists, theistic evolutionists, and atheistic evolutionists. Okay? Everybody falls in one of those categories. I've not met somebody that didn't. And I've been in this discussion many, many times. We'll get back to these four in a minute, but you need to know these four, because that's how you will find out what they think and what they know. Now, I have new terms for you this Sunday. And once again, these are things you need to be fluent in, able to discuss. Hopefully you'll see why as we go along. This is a witness issue. You bring your friends over, they don't want to talk to you about the Bible, but will they talk to you about fossils? Will they talk to you about progressive creationism versus theistic evolution? They will. They'll talk to you about it. You'll get in a game. You'll be able to fight. You'll be able to talk to your kids. Your kids will stand there and marvel at you, and it won't take you that long. I'm thinking, by the way, of buying you all textbooks. So when you come here, I hand you a textbook that discusses this for you. And then I'll just have to say, open your textbook to page 8. And here we go. And will you have to put book covers on them? Yes, you will. You have to put your name in it. And if you get bubble gum stuck between the pages, what happens? A beating. That's absolutely right. A beating. You have to buy 5 more books and your grade drops 1 letter grade. Fees. There are fees for that. You can write on your book cover. Okay. Here's your new terms. Thermal equilibrium. I don't have time to write it on the board. Thermal equilibrium and the finite speed of light. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the universe has thermal equilibrium. What do I mean by that? Yes, the universe is essentially at the same temperature here as it is out there. Now, what causes thermal equilibrium? Because once the universe is created, is it thermally equal? No, I have to make it equal. How do I make it equal? What process would give me thermal equilibrium across this vast universe? What would do it? What would I use? Let me repeat the topic. Thermal equilibrium and the finite speed of light. Yes, I get thermal equilibrium by having light transfer heat from one place to another, right? And eventually the entire universe has thermal equilibrium. What's my problem? Light has a finite speed. How big is the difference? Oh, it's big. It's so big that light isn't fast enough to cause thermal equilibrium. So there's no explanation why I would have a universe with thermal equilibrium with the finite speed of light. Light can't, it's called a horizon problem. Light cannot get there, has not been able to get there and cause thermal equilibrium. But yet, we all agree that there is such a thing, okay? Steady state versus Big Bang, which is really called QSCC. Okay, quasi-steady state. QSSC, quasi-steady-state creation, versus Big Bang. What's the difference between quasi-steady-state and the Big Bang? Do you know? You need to know. They do. But Big Bang, by the way, is going to bring you into creationism, because if I have a Big Bang, I have to have somebody light it off, right? So the evolutionists... The atheistic evolutionist does not believe in Big Bang and mocks it and discredits it. So every time you see Big Bang, note that you're entering into a discussion of God. So my favorite thing to people is, do you believe in the Big Bang? Most of them think they're now on the evolutionary side. They're not. They're anti-evolutionary. That's great. I love that. Or they're anti-atheistic evolution, because now I reel them in very fast, because there's a logic problem they have. Okay? Steady state says the universe has no beginning or end. Steady state. Always existed, never will stop existing. Quasi-steady state creation. Big Bang says this. There was a rapid expansion of space from a point of infinite density. How big is that point? Very small point. How much density did it have? Infinite. I do not have infinite density. It is obvious. You need to understand what infinite density means. And the Big Bang takes something very small with infinite density and explodes it out. And we have a rapid expansion of space, where quasi-steady-state creation says always has existed, never has not existed, and will continue to exist forever. What definition is that? Yeah, but that's a definition that applies to God, isn't it? God has always existed, never not going to exist. He's forever. They have taken the universe. Quasi-steady-state creation is an attribute of God applied to the creation. Okay? Angular momentum. Oh, I gotta hurry. The rotation of the sun is slow. Did you know that? The sun spins slowly. How fast do the planets go around it? Fast. Not fast enough, because it's 15 degrees this morning. Okay, we have angular momentum is in the speed of the planets going around the slowly rotating sun. Angular momentum says, the nebular hypothesis says that mass, how much mass does the sun have? It has 99% of the mass and it only has 2% of the angular momentum. That is the opposite of the nebula hypothesis. The nebula hypothesis says that which has the mass should have the speed. The sun should be spinning really fast and the planet should be going around slow. Think skater, right? My hands are way out here. How fast do I spin? Not fast to pull the hands in. Boom, boom, boom. I get the mass in. The angular momentum causes the rotation. If I have all the mass, I should have all the speed. I don't. I have 2% of the angular momentum. By the way, the sun is tilted on its axis. Do you know by how much? I love this girl. She's smiling. Why are you smiling? You think I'm crazy, don't you? That's my favorite response. See, and I do. When I read this stuff, I go, am I out of my mind? Can I get this into you? Can I do it? How can I do it? Somebody will ask you, how do I know? They come here and spend hours talking to me about this. I hide from them. Transient Lunar Phenomenon, TLP. We know something about the moon, okay? The moon is still geologically active. Why do I know that? If it's geologically active, then it is not cold. It's still hot. If it's still hot, what's it doing? It's cooling, but it's also erupting. You ever look at the moon? You ever spend any time looking at the moon? You have light areas, you have dark areas. What are the dark areas? I'll help you out. Galileo declared them to be seas. He called them Maria or Mare. Now, they're dark because why? They're basalt. What kind of basalt are they? They are volcanic basalt. So, why is it dark? Because it's covered up the light material. What is the light material? That's the material that you see now. And when you see, by the way, viscosity. Do you buy oil? Oil has viscosity. Everything has viscosity. What is viscosity? Viscosity is when I drop something in molasses and I get a little crater, don't I? And the length of time it takes that crater to go back to smooth is the viscosity of the material, if you will. Basalt has a viscosity. The moon has viscosity. I can measure the age of the craters by looking at how fast they are returning to smooth. But never mind. The dark portions of the moon are craters. They call them ghost craters, or craters that have been covered by basalt, a volcanic material. You can still see the craters underneath the volcanic material, but it appears to you to be dark when you look up at it. So what's the obvious question? When did those volcanic eruptions occur? And are they still occurring? TLP. Is the moon still geologically active? I realize that this seems overwhelming. It's physics, it's astronomy, it's math, it's geology, it's biology, it's stuff you avoided in high school. I don't blame you. But it's important that you know how God thinks and how He did what He did and the clues He left behind, because you're going to lay in bed some night and you're going to say, is God really here? And it's going to happen to you. It does, I know. And then you're going to go, what is the viscosity of basalt? Oh, he left a fingerprint. What is transient lunar phenomenon? How come the sun is spinning so slow? And by the way, you need to know the faint young sun paradox. What is the faint young sun paradox? You see, how does the sun produce heat? What's it doing? But let's take you. Are you cold? Welcome to Cliffside. How can I get you warmer? I can burn something. What can I burn here? I can burn natural gas, but if I had a wood stove, I could convert wood into heat, right? I can burn the heat. What happens to the wood as it gets burnt? It disappears, right? It becomes light and heat, doesn't it? Now, if the sun is doing the same thing, what's the mass of the sun? It's a big dude. How many billions of tons of fuel does it burn every second? Lots. What's the obvious question? How long is it going to last? I can take the rate of the nuclear fission, essentially, that's occurring in the sun and figure out how old it is. And all kinds of things, if I can determine its mass. And they think they have. That's the faint young sun paradox, you see, because as it burns more material, what does it become? Al Gore? Yes, as it burns more material, what does it do? It becomes more brilliant and it becomes hotter. And so that's why I don't think it's your Toyota that's causing the problem. I think the sun is naturally getting hotter, as it would over time. Now, if I know how hot it's getting over time, then what can I do? I can extrapolate back. If it has been here for 4 billion years, then 4 billion years ago, the earth was what? Frozen. Yeah, 3 degrees centigrade. Do the math at home. It's about pretty much what it is today here. So, that's the faint young sun paradox. Anyway, I bring all of that up because of 2 Peter. At the end of the age, there will be mockers and scoffers who will deny the creation, will deny the flood, and this entire world will go into apostasy. So, I believe we're at that time. Now, quickly, back to the subject of progressive creation versus literal creation. Are we anywhere near the ram today? It shows up here where it says, now I start the sermon. Page 9. Not going to make it. Progressive creationism proposes that there is death before Adam. Progressive creationism proposes that God is inside of time and space and subject to it. God must operate inside of time and space. That's progressive creationism in a nutshell. It also says that the death that Adam was going through in Genesis 2:17, for in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. That was not physical death, because there was physical death everywhere at the time. That was spiritual death, not physical. And as I said, physical death was constant and throughout. So in other words, I have Adam in the garden, and I have physical death all over and all around the garden. It's everywhere. Adam was fully aware of physical death. He saw it everywhere. It wasn't affecting him. It was constant throughout and commonplace. Now, that is how popular today in the church. Which, by the way, which one is winning in the church today? Literal creation, progressive creationism, theistic evolution, or atheistic evolution? Hopefully you'll rule out this one, because that would seem to be in conflict with church. So you got one of these three. Which one's winning? This one's winning. Which one's second? Oh, this is second. What are we? Sorry, not really. Fake sorry. This is Cliffside. We're getting our rear ends kicked out there. Hopefully you see the problems with progressive creationism just right off the bat. If God is subject to time and space, then what isn't He? Yeah, he's not God. Well said. Who said that? Can't get that better. Yeah, if He is subject to time and space, then He's not all-powerful. And if He's not, because He's not omnipotent, because time and space, He must operate inside of it. And if He must, then He's not more powerful than time and space. That's one of the fivefold lies of Satan, by the way. They need to get my lecture. It's free. They don't want it. But He's not omnipotent, and if He's not omnipotent, then what else isn't He? He's not omniscient, and He's not omniscient, He's not omnipresent, and essentially He's not God, as Matthew said, and you can't trust Him. Because if He doesn't have all the power and all the knowledge, and He's not everywhere at all times, then you can't trust that what He's put together is going to work. Crapshoot. Hope He makes the free throws. And then, death, physical death, must then be defined by Genesis 1:31 as very good. Who here thinks physical death is very good? Does anybody think that? They do. Death then is not a consequence of sin and rebellion, but instead a process by which God designed from the beginning. Death is not the absence of God. In other words, God withdrawing Himself. Death is a deliberate act of God Himself. And now we're back to transitive property. If you declare death to be evil, and God is the author of death and the designer of death, and it is His system that He wants, then what is God? He becomes evil, transitive property. Death is evil, and God is the creator of death, and God is evil, and there you are. Now you're in conflict with Isaiah 5:20. Do not, and the parable of the talents, do not call me evil. You in heap big wampum trouble. And if death was so obvious, death is everywhere. according to the progressive creationists, then when God said, you'll surely die, what would Adam have said back? Yeah. It's your design. What's the penalty here? The whole point of returning to dust, physical death, Genesis 3:19, is that there was no physical death before. Otherwise, what are we talking about? What's the penalty? What's the curse? I'm going to die anyway. Yeah, okay. What else can I eat? Spiritual death, by the way, was present, wasn't it? Surely you'll die. He's already seen spiritual death, Adam has. How do I know that? He's seen spiritual death all the time. How do I know that? Spiritual death is present. Physical death is not. It's the opposite of what the progressive creationists say. How do I know that spiritual death is there? I heard Satan. Satan's there. How's he doing spiritually? He's dead. And Adam knows it. And Eve knows it. So ultimately, this will lead to a typology of Adam. Adam is a type of Christ. And Christology is the missing piece in this discussion. It frustrates me so much that we do not seem to attack the progressive creationists with Adam as a type of Christ. Christ is the last federal head. Christ as the kinsman redeemer. What does Christ do? How can you know I'm saved? Because I will physically die, Genesis 15. Not spiritually die. Can Christ spiritually die? Physical death. Okay, now back to the sermon. 2 minutes, I promise. Do the ram in 2 minutes. The ram is a wedding ceremony. How do I know that? How do I know the ram's a wedding ceremony? How do I get that? Be respectful here. How do I know the ram's a wedding ceremony? Because of those shofars, Mount Sinai and Revelation 4:1, that's the first and the second shofar. Mount Sinai is a wedding ceremony. YHVH and his wife Israel are getting married there. You must know that. And they blow that horn at a wedding ceremony. So I should expect the other horn to be blown at a what? At a betrothal ceremony, and it absolutely is. The book of Deuteronomy to the casual reader of Scripture seems to be a repetition of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. If you think that, you're in horrible disarray. What is the book of Deuteronomy? It does mean second law, a repetition of the law, but what is it? It's in its entire format, it's a systematic ancient marriage contract. Moses took the various facets of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, and he put them into the form of a marriage contract, and God signed it, and Israel signed it. That's what Deuteronomy is. And the shofar is blown at Sinai because we are entering into a marriage contract. And then Israel commits adultery, Jeremiah 3. And then the contract is broken, Jeremiah 31. It's made null and void, Ezekiel 16, 15. I'm rattling these off. I'll do it next week. This is for the people that get these CDs. And then next is the separation, Isaiah 50. And then the divorce, Jeremiah 3. The bill of divorcement. God gives Israel a bill of divorcement. Then there's punishment for that divorce, Exodus or Ezekiel 16. And then there's remarriage. Those who say that Israel will be cast away and thrown out and replaced, wrong. There's a remarriage, Jeremiah 31. Now, the bride of Christ is a totally different picture, a radically different picture. What God says about the church and his and her relationship as the bride of the Messiah is radically, totally different than what he says about the wife. We are not in a marriage. What are we in? We're engaged. We're still betrothed. We haven't yet had the marriage. And that's where next week we'll get back to the 12-step Hebrew betrothal ceremony. When you study the ram, what do you become an expert in? You become an expert in marriage. That's not a bad idea. Ninety 90% of the problems I have with relationships that come to my desk are from people that have no understanding of the Hebrew betrothal ceremony, and they say, how come my marriage is a mess? The ram, Genesis 15, You give me Genesis 15, you give me the Hebrew betrothal ceremony, you watch what happens. Now, there's four key passages in the New Testament. I don't have time to read them. The espousal is 2 Corinthians 11:2. Next week, I want you to label your Bibles. In 2 Corinthians 11:2 is the espousal. Ephesians 5:25-27 is the maturing sanctification part of the four parts. Then, yes, wise Eric, please start pulling them forward. Number three, the marriage occurs in Revelation 19. So I have the espousal, I have the sanctification, or the cleansing, if you will. I have the marriage itself in that Revelation 19. And then I have the eternal abode of the bride, Revelation 21:9-22, where he says in John 14, he says, I go to do what? To make a eternal abode for you. Eternal. Very important. Doctrine of immortality. And Paul calls this in Ephesians, Christ and the bride, a great mystery. So, here's the key question. Why a wedding ceremony? The ram says, how can I know I'm going to be saved? And Jesus answers back to him, a wedding ceremony. The ram. You'll know you're saved if you understand the wedding ceremony. Every time you lay in bed and say, am I really saved? Do I have assurance of salvation? Somebody comes to you and says, how can I know I can be saved? You say to them, well, let's go to Genesis 15 and pick out the ram because it's a wedding ceremony. You'll know you're saved because you'll understand the wedding ceremony. Salvation will be based on a marriage typology or symbolism. That's how you can know you're saved, Genesis 15:8. Take me, take the ram, learn the wedding, and you'll know that you're saved. Why did he pick a wedding? He could have put it in any format he wants, but he puts it in a wedding. Why? He likes weddings. What's he cry at weddings? He play the band at weddings? Why did he make it a wedding? Where's the first wedding? See, Mike Cavallaro, if he was here, he would say what? Ooh, got to think about the angels. But we will say Adam and Eve. First wedding. He put the salvation system into a wedding. He likes it. Adam and Eve, first wedding. Adam made some mistakes, but he did something right. What did he do? Have to learn that. Next week, we'll learn that. Adam went into the thorns. Let's rise and be dismissed.